Auckland Grey Power is pleased to sponsor this edition of Senior Focus.
Good afternoon, listeners. Well, exciting times. There was an election, and when we recorded this, it was the day before polling day, and so maybe New Zealand has a new government, or might take a little bit longer. It is indeed exciting times. And some of you will have been following the transport side of things, and we're going to talk a little more about that. But the outcomes of this election could end up with some quite different outcomes for transport in New Zealand. Now, we're very privileged today to have Cathy Steele talking to us. And Cathy, I'll get her to introduce the topic. She did a master's degree a few years ago, and she was looking at walkability in Auckland. But I'll get her to introduce that so that we get the story correctly. Hello, Cathy.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Very good. Welcome. And Cathy, tell us about the actual piece of work that you did for your master's degree.
Yeah, so it was a Master of Science degree in geography looking at walkability in Auckland. And what I did was I traced sort of the history of Auckland's land use and transport planning through the original planning documents and sort of did an analysis of how we'd gotten to the shape that our city is today and our transport patterns. And I'd just come back myself from 2 years in Edinburgh where I had walked everywhere, and I'd gotten back to Auckland and I was just overwhelmed with how often I had to drive and was really interested in this topic. And so sort of looking at Auckland's development and then the implications for walking and walkability in our city.
Oh, fantastic. And there was a good process. Often with master's degrees you begin with high aspirations and the reality of getting the research done and the constraints, resources, access to people, all those sorts of things can crowd in. But you were pleased with the end result?
Oh, yes, I was very pleased, actually. I had a very supportive supervisor, Professor Robin Kearns at the University of Auckland, and support from people who were involved. So I interviewed just some planners at the various councils at that stage and did some focus groups with sort of different types of households in different suburbs, talking to them about how they make transport decisions and how Auckland's transport patterns influence their households and how they kind of work.
Well, fantastic. Now, tell us when you did this, because that will, you know, you were very much in the thick of things at the time, and time has changed, you know, things have gone on since then. So you completed the research.
I think it was 2005, so it was about 12 years ago now.
Yes.
And Auckland's transport actually looks a little different now from it did then. We've made a lot of progress. So
It does. Now, maybe a place we could begin. One of the topics that has come up with the elections from one of the parties was the idea of light rail and the plan to put light rail down Dominion Road and indeed even to the airport. But once upon a time, of course, New Zealand had an extensive light rail network. And that was in the days when the word gridlock just didn't exist. So tell us about that and how that came about.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things really. You know, looking back to the 1950s, we had a very extensive tram network. I mean, since then, there's been an awful lot of population growth. So I think there was around 500,000 people in Auckland in the 50s, and now we're about 1.6 million, I think. And the growth has really been sustained throughout that period. And we also had a very sustained focus on road building. So we constructed an extensive motorway network and the harbour bridge, and then built suburbs along those motorways. And so we had a much more sprawling land use pattern. And I guess to some extent that mirrored that what was happening in other North American and Australian cities. But the research I did suggested that actually our focus on road building and our dismissal of public transport was quite a lot more dramatic than in most other cities. And one study I read actually showed that we experienced the most spectacular plummet in public transport patronage around the world. And this was as a result of the decision to dismantle the tram system in the 50s and systematically underinvest in our rail network and, as I've mentioned, to build our motorway network and our harbour bridge.
Wow.
So I think in the 50s, it was somewhere between, well, various figures, but between 50 and 58% of all trips in Auckland were by public transport. By the late 90s, it was just 5%. And there's been a little bit of growth again since that point.
So tell us about Auckland in those days and how it could be that many trips were made by public transport. You know, we've got a city today that's 100 kilometres long. Auckland would have been quite different then?
Yeah, so I think most of the suburban development was focused on the isthmus. So the tram lines sort of extended, you know, Point Chev, Avondale, Mount Albert, Mount Roskill, Three Kings, Onehunga, Ellerslie, Meadowbank, and I think most of the development was along those tram lines. And there was a small amount of development on the North Shore, which was serviced by ferries. So so it was all very oriented around public transport. We also had passenger rail services. So railways were built from the 1870s, and there were passenger services to Onehunga, Henderson, Papakura and Ōrākei. And I guess by the 50s, the tram network was there and people were using it. There was you know, growing rates of motor vehicle ownership across the city. And then I guess the car began to come to prominence across the developed world, really. And most cities started to grapple with this question of how do we integrate the car into our city? And one of the answers was to build motorways and allow urban sprawl.
Yes. So tell me, we will get on to the thing with cars, but what do you think it would have been like? You know, to get to the tram, people would have generally walked to a lot of people lived reasonably close to a tram line.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't speak to a lot of people from that era, but I know talking to my nan, I mean, she lived in Hillsborough and she used to walk to the tram at Three Kings if she wanted to go anywhere. And she said that's what everybody did. So
how far would she have walked, Kathy?
Actually, I don't think it was too far from where she was.
Yes.
So, you know, sort of 15 minutes, I guess.
But, yes. So, yeah. So if that was typical, that means that a lot of people were walking a lot of the time to get to their tram, or I guess were there bus services in Auckland then as well?
Yeah, I think there were, and I'm not sure about that.
No, it's interesting, but we can be sure that a lot of people were walking and getting all the benefits from that. And then they were able to sit down and relax on the tram and not have to worry about the gridlock today.
Exactly.
Yes. So things changed. And my understanding after the Second World War is that there was a huge amount of industrial manufacturing capability that was used over the period of the war to build stuff for the war that was all of a sudden not needed for that purpose. And there was an explosion of consumer goods that became accessible to everybody, refrigerators and ovens and all the sorts of things we see in our house. The other thing that the cost came down for these things and the motor cars became suddenly affordable. And so, but it needed more than that to bring about the change that you described in terms of the greatest drop in the world of the use of public transport. So what sort of policy changes took place in that time to bring about the changes that you've described?
Yeah, so there were a few things. In the 1940s, 1940s, Wellington's rail network was electrified, and this prompted debate about whether to electrify Auckland's rail. And so a report was commissioned from British engineers called Halcrow Thomas and Partners in the 1950s, and this recommended electrification of Auckland's railways and the construction of an underground section linking the central rail station with the Western Line at Kingsland. And if this sounds familiar, it's because it's essentially what we're now constructing in 2017, the City Rail Link.
Yes.
So this was 92 years after it was first suggested. So what happened is, on receipt of that report, the then Auckland Regional Planning Authority was apparently ensued in debate over whether to invest in road or rail transport. And a technical advisory committee of that authority recommended motorway construction instead. And they actually completely dismissed the public transport option, despite the fact that it accounted for more than 50% of trips at the time, and that motorway construction commenced. And then the Harbour Bridge was opened in 1959, and that facilitated sort of urban expansion to the North Shore.
Is there any material around which gives any insight into why that decision was made, why that recommendation was made?
From my understanding is that every local authority in the region sent their chief traffic engineer to the committee, and there was one sole representative of railways from the Central Government Railways Board at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite unsurprising that that group decided in favour of the road building option, given that it was dominated by traffic engineers.
Interesting. And traffic implied cars in that, because of course there would have been a variety of other road users at the time. Hey, we're going to take a little break. We've got daylight saving this weekend, and Joe, our technician here, has chosen a track, Summertime. So let's listen to Summertime. well. That has to be one of my all-time favourites, Summertime. And I am looking forward to Summertime, as I am sure listeners are today. Well, we've just heard that a possibly somewhat stacked committee of transport planners and one representative from the rail part of the government got together and made a decision that forever changed the face of Auckland. Tell us about what that meant. What came out of that decision, Cathy?
What came out of that was a bunch of road building in the motorway construction, which 10 years later already had a congestion problem. At the same time, the trams were being removed and replaced with trolley buses, and rail services were reduced as well as ferry services. So it was sort of unsurprising that people took to their cars in such large numbers. Following that, Auckland engaged some American consultants called Deloe Kather and Company to create a transport plan for the city using computer modelling. And that firm actually recommended quite a balanced transport plan that included a bit of additional motorway building, and a second harbour crossing and a rapid transit plan. And that is the rapid transit plan that formed the basis of Robbie's Rapid Rail, which many listeners may remember. The Auckland City Mayor, Dove Meyer Robinson, was a tireless champion for this rapid rail plan in the 1970s. But unfortunately, it was not constructed. He eventually got a Labour government to agree to fund the proposal, but they never followed through. And then a national government was elected, and in 1976 they cancelled the plan completely. So this was sort of an early failure of this proposal that is now being built in the City Rail Link. But even back in the 1960s, this report warned that if the rapid transit plan was not constructed, Auckland would have an ongoing traffic congestion problem, and that we were really planning for that in the future by not building it.
And today that congestion is costing us $2 billion a year. So we've had congestion growing in that period. Anyone who talks about Auckland talks about the big smoke and talks fearfully about driving in Auckland and the traffic. Tell us about some of the policy decisions that came after those significant decisions were made, and what have been the implications of those, Cathy?
So sort of the late 1970s and 80s, there was a period of fiscal conservatism, and there was very little investment in transport, and that sort of reflected the times and the oil shocks and the economic decline. Then in the 90s, public transport was privatised, and so the regional council was required to contract for bus services to private providers. And the government sold the railways in the 90s to Transrail, and there was quite a lot of dilapidation of Auckland's rail system and just underinvestment. So that sort of got us to the point in the late 90s of a historic low in public transport and fairly terrible congestion. In more recent years, we've sort of turned a corner. So while motorway projects are still being completed, there's also been much greater investment in public transport, walking and cycling. We're almost turning a corner these days.
And tell us about some of the, coming back to your theme of policy decisions, that corner being turned. When did that start, and what were some of the reasons?
Sort of around the 2000s. So I think the policy started to recognise that actually we need a more integrated transport network that offers people choices, that that is less that contributes less emissions to the environment, that gives people choices and enables sort of healthy lifestyles. So we've seen investments like the construction of the Northern Busway, double tracking the Western Rail Line, electrification of the rail network, integrated fares and smart card ticketing, so you can tag on and off any public transport services quite easily, reconfiguration of bus routes, and better bus frequencies. So as a result of this, we have seen some really big, exciting increases in public transport patronage recently. And there's also been big investments in cycleways. And now we're seeing a growth in cycling as a result. The investment in walking and walkability is much harder to measure. We don't really collect much data on pedestrian numbers, but I know that the council has a project underway to start doing this. So once they do, it will be exciting to see some of those results.
Yes.
So in saying this, we're still investing plenty in state highways and in big roading projects. So, you know, we've also built recently the Waterview Tunnel, the Newmarket Viaduct, Victoria Park Tunnel, the extension of State Highway 20 to 1 Manukau, the new State Highway 20 Manukau Harbour Crossing, and lots of other programs. And, you know, we have some upcoming controversial decisions to make, such as the East-West Link. So.
Yes. So just going back to that drop in public transport use in the that was in the 70s, 60s and 70s?
From the 50s. It was from a sustained decrease, yes. Right through to the late 90s.
So how much of that would you attribute to the lack of investment or the running, seemingly running down of the public transport services, or how much would you put that down to the availability of motor cars?
Well, look, I'm not sure, Richard. I mean, but I think they're probably mutually self-reinforcing. So, you know, as more people are using cars, then public transport becomes less viable, and then more people use cars, so it becomes even less viable, and it's sort of a self-reinforcing decline. So, yeah, but hard to speculate on exactly how much.
Yes.
What contributed the most. The other thing that was happening at the time, of course, was further urban sprawl, which is much harder to service with public transport and much easier to service with a motor car. So.
Yes, it is. It is. All right. Hey, this is interesting. So we're going to listen to another track of music. Simon and Garfunkel made Scarborough Fair very popular, and this was a music that I was listening to in the 70s, and just in those times when I did ride a bicycle, but it was an interesting time. But here we're going to listen to Scarborough Fair now.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cabaret shirt.
Wonderful, wonderful. I can remember crooning away out of tune with my guitar in my bedroom trying to sing that song many, many, many years ago. Now, you've touched on walking a few times, and I know walkability and walking was one of the priorities for your master's degree, Kathy. Tell us a little about what you've found about walking in Auckland over this period of your study.
So what I really found in talking to households was that people wanted to walk, but they often felt they needed to use the car just because of where they lived and where they worked and their busy rushing lives trying to get children to activities and things like that. No doubt the car has extended the bounds of where people can go and given them greater access to family and friends and education and leisure, but with it, it's brought a lot of complications. So what I found was that people really lamented the lack of social interaction that they got in their car-dependent suburbs, and they liked walkable places because there were kind of opportunities for chance encounters or more chance of getting to know your neighbours as you walk to school or to the shops. And there's a lot of research now showing that walkable neighbourhoods are more social and they're more socially cohesive as well. For instance, I read a study recently which showed that citizens are even more engaged with like non-profit and charitable groups in walkable neighbourhoods. So that was one interesting thing. The other big upshot of people walking less is obviously the health implications. And greater obesity and sort of lifestyle diseases as people not getting any exercise, walking and cycling around their neighbourhoods as they would have done in the past. And we have a huge obesity problem in New Zealand now. Over half of adult New Zealanders don't meet the recommended minimum physical activity levels of 30 minutes on 5 days per week. And obviously this could be quite easily solved if we were all needing to walk or cycle for our transport.
Yes, and so I guess walking is in the suburbs, there are footpaths, but in the centre of the city itself, and we've only got a little under 2 minutes to go, what changes do you think might be needed to promote walking in the CBD area?
I mean, I'm a big favour of a big pedestrianisation project for our CBD. A lot of cities are going this way now. And one of the really common policies now is this car-free city. So Oslo recently adopted a plan for a car-free city by 2019, which is only 2 years. Madrid is pedestrianising much of its city centre and redesigning roads and banning cars. Hamburg is another really interesting city, building lots of greenways, and they're introducing a car ban on a number of urban roads, which will become a big green network, and link up their river with parks and gardens and playgrounds and that kind of thing. And a lot of other cities are going this way as well, even across North America and even South America. So I think we need to be looking hard at that as a policy option for our city centre.
Wonderful. Now, we're going to have to draw to a close there, Kathy. Hey, thank you so much for your time today. Wonderful. Listeners, this is Richard Barter. I may have failed to introduce myself at the beginning. If you want to get in touch with me, you can send me a text on 021-277-1213. Always interested in your views on transport in Auckland. And thank you again for listening to us today and looking forward to being with you next month. Thank you, Kathy. Bye-bye for now.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus, and do note Senior Focus is one word.